You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, May 6, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of history from Illinois State, Andrew Hartman, on his book, A War for the Soul of America, A History of the Culture Wars. Also on the program today, North America Goes Socialist. Well, more specifically, Canada. Well, more specifically, Alberta. More specifically, not totally socialist, but even still. Also on the program today, Hillary Clinton scheduled to stake out an even more aggressive position on immigration than the current administration. Meanwhile, Clinton campaign chairman on TPP, can't you make it go away? Also, the strange story, the discovery of extensive surveillance by air over Baltimore over the past week. Missouri decides poor people got it a little bit too easy, and for their benefit, we're going to give them more freedom in the form of less to eat, particularly those kids. Couple gets 15 years for sex on a beach. And California will be cutting water for some areas by 28%. All that and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, had Huckabee announced that he was going to be in?
He's in.
Well, had he done that by yesterday or by Showtime yesterday or no?
He did that yesterday, yes. We talked about it. We mentioned it.
Okay.
We mentioned Mike Huckabee.
I don't even
Carly
remember.
Fiorina, who you have trouble saying her last name.
But Ben Carson.
And Ben Carson, yes, who you called Carlson.
Ben Carlson?
Yes.
I guess it's one of those.
It's a full Republican clown car now, and it's gonna be a bit difficult to keep up with all the different crazies.
Indeed. All right. Well, just briefly, I mean, I don't know much about Alberta, Canada's politics, but it seems to be a pretty big deal up there. The New Democratic Party, or New Democrat Party in Alberta, has won a majority. They defeated the Progressive Conservative Party, which has held power since 1971. And prior to that, the center-right Social Credit Party held power from 1935 to 71. So you've had, over the past 100 years or so, 90 years, you've had two parties that were both center-right at best. This is the first center-left government Alberta will have in at least 80 years. And apparently, the winner, a woman named Rachel Notley, swept all 19 seats in Edmonton and had made some inroads in the formerly barren NDP territory in Calgary and Lethbridge. None of that means much to me, other than it's pretty stunning. She ran on a policy platform of social change, promising to invest more in schools and hospitals while increasing taxes to corporations and the wealthy. Her father set up the party back, I think, in the early 70s. So interesting turn of events in Alberta, Canada. Meanwhile, in Israel, Bibi Netanyahu could be having trouble forming his own government. And today is the deadline, but we will get to that in a bit. First, we need to take a break so that we can bring up Professor Andrew Hartman. Reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member today at majority.fm. It is your support, folks, that makes this show possible. We would have no show without members. We'd have no free show. We'd have no member show. We'd have nothing. Just have like a 5 o'clock shadow. That's all that would be here. And for those of you who listen to this show, you'd hear nothing because 5 o'clock shadow doesn't make any noise. So if you have the financial resources, please become a member today. If you want access to the bonus part of the show but don't have the financial resources, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We won't turn you away. We'll make a deal. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Don't forget, just coffee, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Remember, now it's all free shipping. We'll be back in just a moment. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of History at Illinois State, Andrew Hartman, author of A War for the Soul of America, A History of the Culture Wars. Welcome to the program, Andrew.
Thank you, Sam, so much for having me on the program. I'm excited to be here.
So, I got a lot of questions about your book some things I think I may end up ultimately disagreeing with in terms of some of your assessments in terms of where we are today. But let's go back and for the sake of all of us, I mean, define for us what you mean when you talk about the culture wars.
Sure. So I define them as a struggle over national American identity. And this struggle over an American identity goes back to the very beginning of the nation. But I'm mostly interested in the book, in particular, the debates that have taken place over American identity since the 1960s, because I argue that there was a sort of cultural revolution during the 1960s, wrapped up in the New Left liberation movements, Black Power, feminism, gay rights, that really sort of transformed American culture. And that the culture wars have been a legacy of that transformation. Conservatives, both religious and secular conservatives, have been fighting back against that transformation since then, and that's sort of defined the culture wars as this polemic between those who embraced these changes in the 60s, liberals and progressives, and those who obviously did not.
So, I mean, should we see your reference to culture wars as a particularly volatile chapter or polarized chapter of sort of an ongoing culture war that is America, or is it? I mean, is it distinct in its nature, or is it a part of a longer story?
If possible, I would argue both. I mean, I argue, and I would say that many historians would agree with me, that these types of cultural conflicts over the very notion of American identity go back to the founding of the nation, go back, in fact, to the Declaration of Independence, because, you know, the United States of America is based on an idea, and this idea is sort of open and capacious, and people have thought about what exactly it means ever since then. All men are created equal from the Declaration of Independence did not mean the same thing to those who wrote it as it has later come to mean to millions of Americans. So this is an ongoing history and will continue going forward. We're going to continue to debate this, and so cultural conflict is nowhere near at an end. It will never end for the United States of America. That said, the era that I focus on in the book, from the 60s up through the mid-90s towards the end of the 20th century, I think is a particularly heated and polemical period in American history, because these transformations to American society were so new. America was more open to feminist ideas, more secular, more racially tolerant, or at least less sadist. And there were many Americans who really were uncomfortable with these changes, especially because they came upon so seemingly rapidly. And so the period of the 80s and 90s was a very intense sort of moment of debate, and I would argue an adjustment period for many Americans to this new America.
And so let's go to, and then, you know, we will circle back to your differences with people like Thomas Frank and maybe folks like Rick Perlstein, who see a lot of the construction of this cultural war to be a opportunistic by political movements. But before we get there. And by political movements, I mean specifically sort of, I guess, more electoral political movements. But let's start with where the first fissure in this culture war took place. And you trace it to between the new left and the neocons. Define for us the new left and tell us who the neocons were.
Sure. The New Left was a sort of an umbrella term that I use and that many historians now use to refer to a whole host of movements that arose out of the 1960s. That would include civil rights, or at least the more radical end of civil rights, the Black Power movement, other ethnic identity movements like the Chicano Power movement, the American Indian movement, would also include women's liberation or second wave feminism and the gay rights, gay liberation movement that sort of took fire after the Stonewall riots of 1969 in New York City. That as a whole is the New Left, and I think although many of their goals politically were unsuccessful, especially in terms of, say, ending the war in Vietnam, which was one of the major goals of the New Left, or making for a more sort of socialistic America. Those goals failed. In terms of culture, in terms of cultural power, I think these movements were highly successful in changing American culture. And it was the neoconservatives who first arose to resist this new left and to give America and the conservative movement a language for resisting the new left. And this is a new argument I make in the book, because most people, when they think about the right side of the culture wars, they only think about Jerry Falwell, Phyllis Schlafly, the religious conservatives, who are important, but I would argue that they sort of took on the argument of many of the neoconservatives. And these were people formerly on the left. Some of them were Trotskyists in the 30s. Others were Cold War liberals. These are people like Irving Kristol and Norman Poderitz, even Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Midge Dekter, Gertrude Himmelfarb, Nathan Glaser. These were people who we're to some degree on the left, but we're extremely uncomfortable with the new left and thus shifted to the right as the new left has sort of started having these cultural victories.
And I think, you know, help us in terms of just sort of tracking the intellectual development, or I should say the development from an intellectual historian perspective of the neoconservatives. Because I think when most people hear neoconservatives today, they think, Richard Perle and Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz, they see only the sort of neoconservative streak as it's manifested in foreign policy, and don't realize that comes out of this sort of, I guess, intellectual movement where the idea being that, a neoconservative is when a liberal, gets mugged, essentially.
Yes, yes. And that is a sort of popular misconception about the concept or term neoconservative, the label, that I think has become even more prominent, this misconception, ever since the neoconservatives seem to have some influence over the Bush administration foreign policy with the war in Iraq. Neoconservatives have been extremely interested in a more hawkish foreign policy since the late 70s or early 80s, but it emerged in the late 60s and early 70s mostly out of interest in domestic social policy issues like welfare, like affirmative action, like crime, and also as an opposition intellectual movement to the new left, especially black power, but also including feminism and gay rights. And so these early neoconservatives, especially Kristol and Poderitz, were much, much more focused on what was happening in their midst, in their city, in New York City, or Nathan Glaser was much more focused on what was happening on his campus, Berkeley, than they were what was happening, say, in the Middle East.
Now, at that time, I mean, was this cleave about sort of social power, or was it about how social power translated into economic power?
I think you could say that it was much more about social power, but that, and the neoconservatives had a sort of idealistic vision of American life, and that was that, if you worked hard, eventually things were going to pay off. So they became sort of the quintessential bootstraps Americans. They looked at themselves, I think, a little bit idealistically as, say, working class Jews who had made it in American life, as professors, as intellectuals, as writers, as renowned writers. And they thought that, well, why can't, for example, African Americans do the same thing? Why do they need things like affirmative action? Why do they need on campuses black studies, which seemed sort of hostile to the very idea of American opportunity? I think it was a sort of distorted vision of what they had actually achieved and how they had achieved it, especially since many of them were involved in sort of student protest movements and other sorts of movements that were not that far removed from the Black Power movement of the late 60s or, for example, the gay rights movement.
Well, even there, I'm sort of a little bit unclear, because when you talk about this comes out of a sense of, we as working class Jews, we worked hard and we made it, and it sort of it created this sense of the neoconservative mind that like these sort of giveaways are problematic in some way. Like I don't when just that that the construction of we made it, is that exclusively a cultural thing, or is that also an economic thing? I mean, because this is where, because you talk about the paradox of sort of what ultimately sort of defeats, I think, the right in the culture war, and I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but I'm still trying to get a sense of did the culture stuff that was adopted by the neoconservatives, was that simply a more comfortable way of articulating, hey, I don't want to have to compete with everybody for my job?
that may be one way of looking at it. Here's how I would look at it. They did not necessarily, and I'm talking about the neoconservatives, did not necessarily sort of disassociate social and cultural power from economic power or from their conception of capitalism. And so when I say that they said, hey, we made it, why can't you make it just like we did? This was their vision, not only of what it meant to be an American, but how a capitalist society operated. They thought that people had to sort of take responsibility for themselves and be compelled by social and cultural norms to take responsibility for themselves, or a capitalist society would wither away and die. And so in effect, they were sort of bringing together a cultural and economic forms of analysis in the same way that a black power analyst and activist like Stokely Carmichael was. It was Stokely Carmichael in his book about black power that sort of coined this term institutional racism, in which he's bringing together these forms of cultural analysis that sort of focused on racism with economic forms of analysis about how blacks economically could not sort of achieve the same levels of success in America society as could whites because of these institutional barriers.
So, I mean, so talk about, I mean, reconcile this with the idea of, I mean, and I think you didn't coin this phrase, the age of fracture, but that is what the description of this period was, because you talk about we had a normative America. Describe for us what the normative America was, so that people have a notion of what that means and what was lost for some people.
Sure. So when I use this term and then say I'm teaching my students and they're like, what is this normative America? What's the professor talking about? I usually give them some images or video clips from 1950s television, like Leave It to Beaver. And that is, there was a, you know, much more sort of conformist vision of what it meant to be an American in terms of gender expectations. The men were expected to work outside the home. The women were expected to stay in the home and care for children. I think that also there was a much more sort of narrowly conceived notion of religion in American life. It was the 1950s when you see a sort of outpouring of civil religion, a sort of outpouring of conflating notions of American identity with Christian identity. It's the 1950s when you're least likely during that period to have sort of challenging views of American history that take into account, say, atrocities against Native Americans or the history of slavery as being endemic to American history. All of that was, to some degree, way too idealized, and of course there was always dissent, but it was very pervasive, more pervasive, I would argue, in the 50s or the early post-war culture than any time since then, and perhaps any time before then. And so this was the sort of idealized American society that so many conservatives had come to appreciate as the true American ideal that the 60s and the movements of the 60s revolted against, and that's why it was in part so disturbing to so many people.
And it doesn't really matter whether or not, and you know, obviously, the you know, that Leave It to Beaver world was great if you were the Beave or even Eddie Haskell and the parents, because you weren't black and you weren't gay and you weren't, mom was perfectly happy wearing a dress. You know, I think her name was June, if I remember correctly. But, in your analysis, it doesn't really matter whether or not you actually enjoyed that or lived that life or simply sort of perceived yourself as you could live that life, right? Because, I mean, if you're growing up in Brooklyn as one of these future neocons, right, that wasn't your life. I mean, Beaver was pretty far removed from your experience.
That's right, but when I say it's a cultural norm, it's sort of a it's an aspiration, and so an increasing number of Americans did in fact live like that, and you see this in the growing movement of suburbanization, or otherwise known as white flight. But yes, many Americans were barred from this for a whole host of reasons, or just in terms of just cultural and demographic difference. And yet it was an aspiration, and especially I think becomes a sort of retroactive aspiration as we move through the 1960s and into it. It becomes a sort of nostalgic rendering of American identity that is fixed in the conservative imagination.
And so when the neocons were at the sort of the tip of the spear, I guess, in terms of responding to this new era where there is, you know, sort of broader social liberation, they're upset because they had this aspiration of living the Leave It to Beaver life. They get close to it as they're going to come based upon their roots. And now all of a sudden, everybody feels like they can move into the neighborhood without doing what they did.
Yeah, I think there's some of that. There also might be a sort of sense that, well, maybe that's not the life for us, but that's the life that holds America together. So you might see this, for example, in Irving Kristol's arguments for a religiously fused America. He himself obviously is a Jew and a secular Jew, not a very religious man, but he made plenty of arguments that American democracy could only survive if it's infused with religious values. It's sort of like this is the type of thing that keeps the masses from regulating themselves, from behaving, from not becoming an unruly mass, a mob of people. Religious values keep people sort of grounded. And so he was a proponent of a sort of Protestant America. He might have said a Judeo-Christian America, even though he himself was not a religious person. And so for the neocons, who are intellectuals and they might have had a sort of ironically elitist view of things, and I say ironically because really they're sort of the intellectualization of the white working class, but they weren't necessarily living this way, but they were advising that most Americans should.
And to what extent, I mean, yesterday we interviewed Kevin Cruz from Princeton, who's written about the development of that, of what you described, the sort of the intertwining of the American identity and the Christian identity. And mm-hmm. according to Cruz, this was a conscious project launched by the National Association of Manufacturers, who
yes.
were looking for a basically pushback on the New Deal and wanted to reverse a lot of the New Deal gains. And it didn't really get traction until the late 40s, early 50s. How does that play into this development of the culture war? And how does that impact your sense that part of this was opportunistic? I mean, part of this, mm-hmm. this cleave was in fact manufactured, or at least enhanced or amplified, because there was a political economic agenda behind it.
Yes. So I haven't had a chance to read Cruz's new book. It's brand new. It's at the top of my list, but I've read several sort of essays that he's written about it or reviews of the book. And so I think I have a sense of his argument. And I would say that, that makes a lot of sense, you know, that the National Association of Manufacturers would try to sort of enhance this bringing together of American and Christian identity, and that it would be opportunistic. They would be crazy not to have been opportunistic. And that would be my larger argument about politicians and, you know, economic elite more generally. They're going to do what they can to take advantage of these cultural cleavages to the best of their ability. They're going to, you know, ride these cultural waves. And so for a historian, I guess it boils down to which, you know, what do you think is more important, these cultural forces that perhaps are deeply rooted, or the economic and political actors that are taking advantage of these cultural forces? And so it's a chicken or egg question. I wouldn't necessarily argue it's either or. They're both there. They're both present. But sometimes I think, and this is my critique of Thomas Frank's argument about the culture war, sometimes I think the idea that it's manufactured, the idea that these cultural conflicts are superficial, that to me is, in fact, what's really superficial about that type of analysis.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate that. I mean, I think you know, I mean, based on just the conversation and my read of Cruz's book, that he would argue that this is not the National Association of Manufacturers riding a wave, but rather it was them specifically actually seeking out and without much success for a long time, but seeking out pastors to preach a gospel that was basically like, it is anti-American and anti-godly to provide, you know, retirement support. I mean, I'm reducing it slightly, but not yeah. much. And I think, you know, there is, there is a difference, it seems to me, between sort of an innate, I guess, predisposition to a certain perspective, and one which is really nurtured and continued perpetuated, because, you know, that takes, you know, it's one thing to have a seed there, but you need it to be watered and cared for. Yes. So I don't know if I would see it as much as riding a wave, as much as like the water may be there, but also sort of bringing in the wind and the gravity.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. Well, let me just speak to my own argument then, since I can't really speak to Cruz's. And so in the 1970s, you see this huge wave of religious conservative, a growing animus towards the state, towards the federal government. And the question is, why are so many, perhaps millions of evangelicals growing so angry at the federal government? And so for me, I don't see this as in any way manufactured. To me, this is a sort of reaction against the increasing secularization of the public sphere in American life, as represented by, for example, Supreme Court decisions such as the 1962 Engle versus Vitale decision that ruled that prayer in school is unconstitutional, or by the Carter administration's IRS
right.
going after the tax exempt status of a number of Christian day schools on the basis that they were sort of ways to continue Jim Crow segregation, or you know, the list goes on and on.
But that's hard to sort of parse, isn't it? On some level, I mean, I guess that's what a historian does. But you know, I'm offended in terms of my religious values because of the tax exempt status, or the people who are going to actually have to pay taxes are sort of encouraging me to be offended and sort of framing this as a secularization of America in some way.
Yeah, but a lot of this was at the grassroots level. I mean, the most success that conservatives had in this era from the 70s on through the 90s was usually when they managed to get their own people elected to school boards, and then they would create, for example, local laws in which that demanded creationism be taught, which the Supreme Court would strike down eventually, or they would create reading. They would ban books from reading lists that they found offensive, or that they would ban sex education. I mean, I don't think the sort of manufactured outrage is a very good, or it doesn't work well as a historical explanation for as to why millions of these people are getting active at the local level from the 1960s onwards.
And so let's move forward. I mean, one of the things that I found really interesting too is that you argue that the idea of the power of culture, of popular culture in particular, sort of it flipped in the construction of like how the left saw it and how the right saw it. Will you explain that dynamic?
Sure. So the new left, one of the sort of major intellectual contributions they made was the increasing, the notion that they could change society through cultural analysis, through convincing people to live differently, to think about how they live differently. This was especially prevalent, say, in feminism and the sort of consciousness raising of the women's liberation movement. But by the time you get to the 1980s and 1990s, especially when it comes to debates about popular culture and art and censorship, increasingly the liberal defense of forms of art that many people found offensive, such as Andres Serrano's Piss Christ, which, for those unaware, was a photo of the artist's, a jar of the artist's urine in which he had dunked a crucifix. The defense of this was not that there was any sort of redeeming cultural merit. Some people might have argued that, but most people on the left, most liberals, just said, this is what a society committed to free expression is all about. So it was a much more sort of abstract defense. Not that this image or any sort of cultural images are going to change the culture for better or worse, but rather that we should just sort of allow it all to flower. It was conservatives who increasingly in this context were arguing that it was such cultural forms that were changing American society, and not for the better. So this is when you have, for example, Pat Buchanan making the claim that culture is the Ho Chi Minh Trail to power. And I think an increasing number of conservatives really took that to heart, and it's why they became culture warriors. It's why they committed so much of their political energies to fighting these cultural battles.
So you, from your perspective, the cultural war is over. Talk about that, because I have a tough time sort of putting my arms around that. And that's why I sort of wanted early on to define what the cultural war is, because it seems from my perspective, and I think it'll probably other historians would make this case, like a guy like Rick Perlstein, would be that really the culture war is really more of a dynamic is perpetuated by, it is endemic to the existence of conservatives. As freedom expands and society progresses, there's a constant culture war, because conservatives will react against it. So today we may have marriage equality, but the fight tomorrow will be about discriminating against gays in the workplace or with transgender people.
I actually wouldn't agree with that analysis, the whole sort of concept of the dynamic. Admittedly, and I make the argument in my rather short conclusion that the culture wars are over, or rather that their history, I admittedly am on thin ice in making that argument. It's sort of a provocative conclusion. But most of the, I would say that, say, three quarters of the debates that really animated the culture wars in the 80s and 90s, and I think of these as a very specific historical moment, the 80s and 90s, in terms of those culture wars. I see most of those, the anger has sort of gone away for many people, and it just, we're not as riveted by these things. So take, for example, one of the main debates of the 80s and 90s, and that was over what should be taught in the universities, especially in the humanities. You had these debates that just raged about the so-called Western canon, the books that should be assigned in the humanities that represented American civilization or Western civilization. At that period, liberals and conservatives, everyone was sort of engaged in this debate and had very different visions of what books should be assigned, of what the humanities should represent, but everybody valued the humanities. William Bennett, who was first the chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities in the first Reagan administration and then Secretary of Education in the second, was sort of like the chief conservative educational culture warrior. he believed that every American, no matter what, should be the focus of their entire education should be on the humanities or the Western canon. Everybody should have to read Socrates and Shakespeare and even Marx. So he had a type of argument that no conservative today would probably publicly make, at least none with any power, say, now we are in a sort of time of austerity in which Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, is arguing that we should just dismantle the humanities, or at least it's a luxury good that people should have to pay for, because if higher education does anything, it should just be training people to do what I would interpret as menial work. You have politicians in Florida who are trying to pass legislation that degrees in the humanities, history, English, those type of degrees should cost more money. So the debate has just shifted entirely. And you can see this in a number of arenas. And I would argue that, you know, in terms of how we conceptualize gay marriage or homosexual rights, you can see something very similar. And so conservatives say, a Christian conservative in the 80s would have made the case that they represent all of American society and American identity, and that homosexuality is a sort of abomination in relation to American identity. Serious conservatives can't really say that publicly anymore and be taken seriously. And so instead you have sort of much more limited types of culture wars. Conservatives have taken to sort of creating their own autonomous, trying to create their own autonomous communities. And you see this, for example, in the Indiana Religious Freedom Law, which was just an attempt to sort of allow for conservative religious values to be animated in just Indiana. And even that failed. It was probably too large of a sort of autonomous zone. So in many cases, I think that the key debates of the culture wars, the sort of logic is exhausted. But again, I'm on thin ice there, and the cultural conflict will continue, and this dynamic of conservatives reacting against expanded freedom. This is sort of Corey Robbins' theory in A Reactionary Mind, that conservatism is adaptable and it adapts to sort of the expansion of democratic rights. That will continue, there's no doubt.
So the culture war in your definition is a little bit more specific in that sense. I mean, I guess from my perspective, it seems like this could just be, and I guess that's what you mean by being on thin ice, is that this could be just more of like a strategic retreat, right? I mean, we go back to the Alamo, and we outlaw gay marriage there, and we wait. I mean, I see this in the context of different times over, you know, granted a shorter period of time span, but, you know, it seems to me that, you know, it's almost like the war on Christmas is sort of a microcosm of this, and that the war on Christmas sort of crops up when other things are not going, you know, there's nothing else on the playing field. And that to a certain extent, that may be sort of, there's a similar dynamic with these sort of quasi-religious but quasi-cultural values. But I want to get to the part about neoliberalism, because you just almost touched on this, that ultimately neoliberalism sort of defeated the culture war. And you have a quote, and I have it in my notes here. I don't know if I've got it exact, but basically, mammon more than Leviathan has rendered the traditional family values passé. And I think there's some truth to that, but you mentioned it yourself, that it seems to me, at least from an cultural identification, the idea of, let's say, the deficit reduction has become, it seems to me, one of those cultural touchstones that, at least on the right, that is in largely meaningless, but it just is, it's an identity. You've got to be for austerity, period. There's nothing in the same way. It's like an article of faith.
Yes. And you might say that the way we debate as a nation almost everything now, from the budget deficit to our foreign policy plays out in very sort of culture wars logic. There's not a lot of sort of parsing of arguments, but it's sort of like choose your sides and let's do battle.
And I would argue some of that's on the left too. I mean, there's been a lot of sort of like throwing off of concern about civil liberties and foreign policy issues on the so-called left, you know, and at least in, you know, Democrats don't have a problem with a lot of things that President Obama has done that they would have had a real problem with if it was, you know, President Rubio or Bush.
Yeah. No, I couldn't agree with you more there. Let's just say that here's what sort of has won across the board since the 1960s. And I would say that a sort of libertarianism is really the true victor here. And there's a left-wing libertarianism that is about the expansion of individual rights, individual freedoms. I now have the ability to do things as an individual, culturally speaking, that I could not do prior to the 1960s. And then on the other hand, there's been the economic libertarianism, which is about not wanting to be taxed, not wanting the federal government or any type of state entity to regulate my economic behavior. That type of individualism, that type of libertarianism, which perhaps goes back to the Declaration of Independence, that is really what has won out since the 1960s. And so it's a paradoxical moment. So, you know, when all of these new left movements expanded the sort of circle of we, the conception of what it means to be an American, what this did was it made, for example, if you were a gay man, you're much more likely to sort of identify with the nation, I would argue, because the nation itself accepts you much more now than it used to. But on the other hand, as more and more people are brought into it, fewer and fewer Americans sort of are committed to the collective in any way. And I think the challenge for those of us thinking about this history and for thinking about the future is to think about how these two things are related. Is it possible to sort of put forward social democratic values in a society that is so incredibly diverse and that is so welcoming of so many different individual rights? When I'm optimistic, I want to say, of course, it's possible, and that's what we should be fighting for. But I think that historically speaking, it seems tough to put forward sort of both strands of liberal values.
Well, that's one. You call it a paradox, and I think at one point you talk about and you I mean to recharacterize what you said. You know, rights have been expanded, but mutual obligations have lessened. But it seems to me that the expansion of those rights it's possible to describe them as libertarian, but they were also sort of founded on a broader sense of democracy, right? I mean, like the idea being, you know, we're going to expand the rights out of our mutual obligations because, you know, those are the flip side of the same coin, the obligations and the rights. And we are – and so it's
No, I think you're exactly right. So, you know, like, for example, when you pass new federal legislation that expands people's rights, that ties the sort of collective whole to all of us are now legally obligated to attend to the rights of those particular individuals who now have expanded rights. But I think at the same time,
serves to make them more mutually obligated to us, or I should say more obligated to us, right? Because now you're part of you now are a full participant in our society, whether it's, you know, we're talking about immigration rights or we're talking about marriage equality. You're now a full participant. So, it increases the obligations on you as well.
No doubt about it. But I guess what I would say is that as we expand the circle of we as Americans, a growing number of us within the circle, some of the people who have long been in the circle are uneasy with who now is in the circle. And so there's less of a commitment to the collective whole by many people. And this to me is the paradox. And so, you know, I don't want to put it in too blunt of terms, but others have. And that is, you know, when you expand, for example, civil rights to African Americans, is the timing of the sort of tax revolt, is this coincidental? And I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's as explicit as that, but I sort of think this is how we have to think about analyzing recent American history and how we think about going forward from here. And that is, to what degree are these cultural changes wrapped up in the larger sort of economic and political changes? And to me, that it's not to dismiss the cultural changes like I think many would have us do, but rather to think about these things as a whole.
Indeed. Andrew Hartman, I can only hope that some of those people you're talking about in that we just get a little bit older, eventually pass away.
I can't predict much, but I will predict that that will happen to all of us. So there you go.
Indeed. All right. Well, you're going out on a limb there, but we'll take it. Andrew Hartman, the book is A War for the Soul of America, A History of the Culture Wars. We have a link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Sam. I enjoyed it.
Bye-bye. I wonder if I could actually have, like, multiple... I'm so obsessed now with that hang-up... with that hang-up sound. Maybe it should be something like, that was great. It's like reinforcing. I don't know. See if we can find... If folks, if you are out there and you have a clip, like, I don't know, like a four-second clip, of like, that was great, or, oh, I loved it, or something like that. That would be a great, I will use that as my custom Skype hang-up sound. All right, we're going to take a
break. I like it.
Now, what is this that you're sending me now? I had Netanyahu appoints Ayelet Shaked, who called for the genocide of Palestinians as justice minister in a new government. You've got to be kidding.
It's not formed yet, but this is what Jewish Home is demanding. And they want the justice ministry. It's not just that she said this horrific thing, but they want to use it as a position to weaken the Israeli Supreme Court and pass new laws that can restrict the activities of the left and Arabs in Israel.
How old is she?
She's like in her 30s.
Oh, she looks like she's like 17.
I just finished my bar mitzvah. I'd like to kill all the Palestinians. And Israel is under attack. Shalom Aleinu.
Oh my God.
She's like, her voice is still breaking.
It's just, you know. She has like a sweet sort of like.
I hope grandma
face.
And grandpa just, like
sort
the,
of such a
the conditions.
Even the guy, when I saw the guy, the first thing I was like, well, he seems like a nice Jewish boy. He's calling for
Naftali Bennett.
Yeah, for the genocide.
He doesn't look like Avdor Lieberman. Looks like a gangster.
Right.
They don't
that's
have
what
that
I'm
look at all. Yeah, that's true. No,
they look like
ah, yeah.
Oh, they just look at them. They're a nice couple. They just moved into the Upper West Side.
They went
over to Zabaz. They picked up a whitefish salad, and then they called for the genocide of the Palestinians.
I could have been an accountant in Flushing, or I could go to Israel and advocate for genocide. So you know, I picked the more exciting path. What are you going to do?
It's unbelievable. I mean, this is the horror, right, of Netanyahu.
Really, really bad.
This is the horror of Netanyahu being up against the wall because you know that there is no human being alive that Netanyahu would not join forces with to maintain power. Like, if Ahmadinejad was around and he could somehow sell this to the rest of his coalition, he's like, look, better to keep him close.
You ever watch The Godfather? I've sent him to Vegas. Yes. And he'll...
if you don't like it, my wife will call you.
Send you fishing.
Deal with her.
But you knew that he would do the most... He has no problem. I mean...
Although... Supposedly, because it's taken them so long to put this together, there's a real question about the viability of how long this lasts. But it just, I mean, this is a far-right country.
Yep.
I mean, that's just the bottom line.
Yep.
I mean, I would say Meretz, which is, you know, which is positioned as like the left party, they're like they're like moderate, and Labor is center-rightish when it comes on these issues. I mean, the Joint List is the only left party they have.
Oh, God. You know, and she's got the word. She wrote, words have meanings. You know, whenever you see that now, I feel like ever since, like, Obama ran in 2008, I don't exactly remember the context in which that became, but that became, like, a right-wing, that was their way, that was their justification for everything.
Words have meaning.
Words have meaning.
You know what I forget? You know what I miss? I remember was also the phrase spiritual mentor, which they used all the time when Reverend Wright first came out. You have guys like Dennis Miller, like, hey, spiritual mentor.
All right, we'll talk about that Dennis Miller thing. I listen. Matt and I have been, Michael and I have been talking about Dennis Miller because I listened to that PO'd. Oh, my God. All right, we got to take a break. We're going to head into the. Fun half of the program. We got a lot of stuff. Mitt Romney, he's still around. I wonder if he's going to jump back into the race. I just realized I'm not getting any attention. And if Jeb Bush can't, if Jeb Bush is number 7 in Iowa poll, maybe there's an opportunity for me. I mean, really, honestly, Scott Walker, really? I mean, come on. You know,
look at
that
guy.
Mitt Romney looks at Scott Walker and says, like, he's genetically inferior to me. You know that, that's like what Mitt Romney is just like sitting around the house going like, Scott Walker could get the nominee.
Right, this is right. There's a black man president. Scott Walker's going to, instead of me.
This country.
The world is upside down.
We've got to move into a mountain in Utah. All right. We're going to take a break, but we're going to talk about that. We will talk about... I don't know. Michael Savage and Alex Jones have talked to each other. It's stunning.
Did you know that Bill O'Reilly and Dennis Miller are on tour together?
Yes, they're doing a comedy tour together. Yes, believe me. I know all about it. I know far more than I really should. All right, we're going to take a break.
Why did we not go to this? It was just here a couple of days ago. We should have went.
My friend, we
should have gotten front row tickets and just yelled at them the whole time.
Honestly, I listened to 20 minutes of Adam Carolla and Dennis Miller, and I really thought like... I was walking home listening to him, and I was just like, I got to get out of here because I'm afraid I'm going to run into traffic now. Like, literally, I just felt like, why is there such a pull for me to run in front of that
the
bus?
Last thing before you die is your slowly life is seeping out of you, and the car has mangled your body. You're just hearing, bah, 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 bah.
The headphones are lying next to my body, The iPhone is the only thing that's not been crushed by the vehicle, and it's just like
it's
you just hear
quite
like,
pristine.
You just hear it like just. She's got great gams.
We should play the tour trailer in the better half.
All right, we're gonna take a break. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me. Use the app. Pick up the app at majorityapp.com, folks. Don't forget the myriad of ways of supporting this show. Become a member. Buy your crap through our Amazon link. I think we may have another phone sponsor, past sponsor, Credo. I will get to that TPP story about Harry Reid in the better half, as well as these other stories. Hopefully I will get to them. 646-257-3920 back in a moment.